the Punk News Podcast for the week of October 29, 2013. And welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. As always, this is Features Editor John Gentile, and like once again, it's the daring duo, the bad duo, the smart duo. I'm here with Managing Editor, Top Dog, Top Ramen, Chief Barker, Jimmy Olsen's boss, Perry White, Adam White. Adam, how are you doing?
There was only really one thing you said there that was accurate. It might have been bad. Hi, how you doing?
Good. Now, Adam, as I understand, you just got back from the Bay Area. I lived in the Bay Area for about 5 years. You were out there for just a couple of days, and I understand you did some record shopping.
I did. I actually met with Mr. Sound Guy and Airman while we were there too.
You don't say.
Yeah, which was pretty exciting. We'd never met in person. So I did my record shopping when we were there. I was at a conference, so I didn't really have like a ton of time to go around and see stuff. I don't actually think that I saw any of the things that tourists are supposed to expect or are supposed to go see when they're in the Bay. Like I don't think I saw the Golden Gate Bridge. I saw like the Bay Bridge, and I'm like, oh, that's a big bridge. So you got that, right? but really, that's probably it. So, Mr. Sound Guy Nerman and I met at one point, and he made me climb some insane stairs because the layout of your city is kind of like a fun house.
You mean San Francisco?
We were in San Francisco at that point. Yeah, we took the BART over the bay there. I guess over the bay, over the water, over the river, the lake, the fjord. So I met him over in San Francisco, and we went for, he said it was the best pizza in America.
Don't listen to people from California. People from California, a lot of awesome food out there in California. Awesome burritos, awesome Vietnamese food, awesome Japanese food. But California pizza is atrocious. You know, I lived there for a while. I'm from Philadelphia. East Coast pizza destroys West Coast pizza is so bad. So bad.
My opinion is usually on the East Coast side of this because I'm like 40 minutes from Buffalo. So we're from like the pizza, chicken wings and heart attack capital of the world, really. It was good. But we had to go to, what is that? Sorry, I don't really know your geography. The North Beach? Is that the...
North Beach is where they have, Fisherman's Wharf. That's near North Beach.
Yeah, so we were walking kind of down the pier, and then we had to get to North Beach. And he was like, we could take a cab or we could walk. And I'm like, well, let's walk because I've never been here, and, you know, I don't want to see the inside of a cab. And then at one point, he was like, okay, it's just over this hill, which was, as I assume, like the Telegraph Hill. And then we had to climb, like, 900 stairs through people's backyards.
Yeah, you
don't really understand it. The whole city is sort of vertical. It's like an Inception thing.
Yeah, it is. I guess it goes back to the gold rush days. I don't exactly know why, but that's just the way San Francisco is. So Sound Guy, Adam, tell me, what sweet, sweet records did you get in the Bay Area? I'm going to pause you for a second. I've lived in New York. I've lived in Washington, D.C. I've lived in Philadelphia. I've lived in the Bay Area. I lived in San Jose. I've lived in Egypt. I've lived in New York. Best record stores in the world, bar none, Bay Area. Can't beat them.
You say you lived in Egypt?
I did.
Pre-revolution?
Pre-revolution. Had my life taken a different turn, I might not even actually be here. I might actually be an archaeologist, digging up stuff in Egypt. I minored in that. In classical and ancient Mediterranean studies, I focused on Egyptology. And I loved it. I'll tell you, I loved it. But I actually took the GRE. I did very, very well in the GRE. But my problem was I didn't have a Latin background. And so I could have went back to school for Latin, or I could have went forward in a different area. And I went forward. But a part of me will always regret that I did not go back for Latin studies so I could do Egyptology. Because, man, I love Egyptology. I love it.
Oh, well, that's totally Not what I expected to be talking about here. Okay.
And I'm going to brag, but Adam, this is true. I can read four forms of hieroglyphic, Egyptian hieroglyphics. That's true.
That's fascinating. That's got to be one of those skills that it is frustratingly, like, you are unable to use that in your day-to-day, but it's in your head.
I actually put on my resume, one time I got an internship at a corporate called Synopsys. They do semiconductors. I had a law internship there, and I had that on my resume, and they thought I was lying. So they gave me a sheet with a tablet on it, and they said, well, can you read this? And I could, but I actually didn't even need to, because it was like it was Ipperware's admonitions, which you could just like recite that from memory, but they thought I was like reading it right there. But this
so they went to like Google image search and hit like hieroglyphics, and that was the most popular one to come up.
Right, right. But Adam, this is not about me. This is about you, Adam. Speaking of excavation, archaeology, and digging through stuff, what wonderful finds did you find in the Bay Area?
Okay, all right. So here's I split this up into two nights. I mean, I was staying in Berkeley, so it just made sense to go to the ones given the little time that I had that I could walk to. So that meant Amoeba the one night and Rasputin the second. And
the Berkeley Amoeba and Berkeley Rasputin.
Yeah, I mean Amoeba, Berkeley, Rasputin, Berkeley. We were right by the university there, so it was just, you know, just like a short walk from where we were doing our thing. I gotta say, if I had to vote between the two of them, I had more fun in the basement of Rasputin than I did over at Amoeba, despite Amoeba's its fame, I guess. I mean, like, I knew about Amoeba and I live in Canada. I didn't really know about Rasputin, except that everyone that I talked to from the Bay Area was like, go to Rasputin. So, I don't know if that means anything. But anyways, okay, so I got to figure out what was which. Okay, so night one in at Amoeba, and I already picked up six things. I didn't go crazy. I did have to, like, get these through a flight without destroying them. But, and, you know, I have to pay for a baby and things like that. Okay, so day one, Amoeba, a copy of White Lung's Sori on LP, which was the...
Nice pick. 12.
Yeah, which, I mean, partly, this is kind of hilarious because I went down to the East Bay and then bought a bunch of Canadian records that I found in your stores, which is kind of funny. And I'll get back to that in a second. The other was right, from Amoeba, Nightbirds, Born to Die in Suburbia.
Another East Coast record.
It is, right? This is totally, I totally bought like nothing that actually originated there, except happened to exist.
That is a great record. I love that record.
I love this record, yeah. So I wanted that one. Totally off the script here, but I really wanted a copy of Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain. And now I have a copy of Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain. So yeah, I'm buying like super popular, boring Pavement records that everyone's heard 500 times. But I wanted that, and I have it now. And I have to say, you were correct. The reggae section at Amoeba was pretty cool.
Oh man. I don't know if the punk is listening to that. I love reggae. Both Amoeba San Francisco and Amoeba Berkeley have great reggae selections, but Amoeba Berkeley is better because they get rarer stuff for some reason. And honestly, they mark stuff too low because they don't realize how valuable some stuff is. I've gotten some phenomenal finds in the reggae section in Amoeba Berkeley.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I had nothing I was going on. I didn't actually end up picking anything up because I was just like, there was an overwhelming amount of stuff there. But man, that's a nice section. There was more reggae stuff there than there was like punk stuff. Even like there was a ton. So yeah, that was quite cool. I really enjoyed looking through that. So that was just me at Amoeba Berkeley. I have to mention that like my Amoeba Berkeley trip, by the way, this is all predicated to, I won't get into the details here, but I guess I sort of like swallowed this serrated crustio. So as I'm at Amoeba trying to buy records, I'm also like doubled over in like horrible pain. I'm better now. So Rasputin, the second night. So I have this habit when I go into record stores where I will go to like I will dig around looking for anything from my sort of four staple acts that I want everything from and probably own like 10 versions of their stuff from.
Hanson, Ace of Base, Spice Girls, and Two Live Crew.
And I never find anything because it never usually works. But you know what? I sort of did on this one. So like, I'll go into a record store and my immediate, and this is no surprise to anyone, my immediate thing is I'm like, okay, what Constantine's records do we have? Oh, okay. There's no Constantine's records here. then what else am I doing? You know, okay, what can I find from the deadly snakes? Unless I'm in Toronto, nothing. Okay. All right. What am I going to find from who else? Constantine's deadly snakes. Lady Hawk is on my thing. Who's my number four? Shit. I'm blanking on number four, but anyways, so usually I go and I do that. So I did that. There's way more in the basement of Rasputin than it felt like there was an amoeba. And it was way more fun to look through. And I don't know why. I think it's just because it was, you were in a room entirely with records. There were no CDs floating around getting up in your business. So that was kind of nice. So the incredibly Canadian trip to, Rasputin, I am holding in my hands right now the pristine white vinyl reissues of Chick Stiggett's Born on the 1st of July and Chick Stiggett's From Scene to Shining Scene. I walked in there and I was like, ooh, this is the 90s for me. I own these now, so I bought those. And then my Constantine's digging sort of provided fruit. I found a copy of Brian Webb's, who is their lead singer's Provider, which is his first solo record. Which is a really beautiful LP. It was like a really cool kind of die cut cover thing there. And it was floating around in the we're not gonna sort this bin, which is, you know, which is really where you want to find stuff, and not feel like a total tool. So I did, and I'm really super happy that I own this.
Adam, I'm glad that your excursion to the Bay Area was fruitful. I gotta say, if you're ever in the Bay Area, people, check out Amoeba, check out Rasputin, check out Streetlight. All three are fantastic chains. I think overall my favorite chain is Streetlight, but you can't go wrong with any of them.
So two important questions, Mr. John.
Yeah.
One, are you recording this show?
I am.
Awesome. Two. Yeah. That one sucked, man. Two. Given your you know, I'm just a young whelp in the realm of vinyl buying. It hasn't completely overtaken my life yet. But you are a seasoned veteran of this war. When you walk into one of these stores, how long are you in there?
Oh, honestly, like Amoeba San Francisco, if I wanted to, I could kill 6 hours in Amoeba San Francisco. Well, not 6 hours, 4 hours. I could kill 4 hours in Amoeba San Francisco because it's so gigantic. I mean, Amoeba San Francisco is probably like six football fields, maybe even bigger. But like Amoeba Berkeley, Amoeba Berkeley, I could easy kill 3 hours. Three hours I could kill. Rasputin Berkeley, 3 hours because it's got that gigantic basement. And plus in the basement, like you saw, they've got so many boxes that aren't sorted, and they've got a lot of sweet stuff in there.
Yeah, and that was the thing that I was really the most. I don't know that I found the most fun about doing that was that, like, you know what? I didn't really want to look at like the bands that were labeled. I wanted to look in like assorted B, like these are all the ones that start with B and we've just put them in there. Like that to me is way more interesting than actually like going, oh, here's the thing that I want. I'm like, no, I want B and I want like the new releases pile, rather the releases, the new arrivals pile. Right. Granted, the new arrivals pile was like, God, it was like
gigantic.
Tenths, gigantic, and like mostly like Supertramp. I don't know what happened there. Like they bought a whole lot of stuff from someone's garage sale, and that was what was in the pile. I don't know. That's what I found enjoyable about it. I don't really want it that sorted because then I don't feel like I'm accomplishing anything. Then it just feels like I'm buying stuff.
Well, Adam, I'm glad you found the gold in them thar hills. And also with us, but never speaking, and I suspect he didn't speak with you either on this spooky Halloween costume, is that friendly ghost, Sound Guy Nairman. Sound Guy Nairman, are you feeling friendly, or will you possess one of us during the podcast tonight? And that Sound Guy Nairman, on top of that, Adam White, you know, I saw another ghoul creeping around. I don't know if you saw him, but in the Punk News offices this week, did you see the track keeper, that creepy little skeleton-looking guy? Did you see the track keeper creeping around? I don't know. I think I might have saw him.
He was by the milkshake nook down near the fountain section of the offices.
I don't know. That guy is creepy. And I mean, I just heard him like whispering like to the air that he said he's got a bunch of rare old tracks and some rare new tracks. So I don't know what the guy was talking about. But wait. Who's that at my door? Oh, crap. It's the track keeper. He's right here. Man, that guy is creepy.
Oh, God.
Hello, John.
Oh,
hello,
man.
Adam. This is the track keeper. And how are you doing out there, all you punk ghouls?
Oh, he smells so bad.
Ugh. It's Halloween, and I'm here to bring you some undead tracks. The first track comes from Zygote. Zygote was a band that formed after Amoebix passed away. This is off their first and only album, and it is called... And it is called Motion. But don't mind me, I'm so surprised that we got this track that I'm, shall we say, beside myself.
back on the Punk News Podcast. I gotta say, Adam, I did not expect the Track Keeper to open up tonight's podcast with some crust punk. Did you?
He's an unpredictable ghoul.
Well, he sure. And I gotta say, Adam, we were so excited about records. We're already about 10 minutes on our podcast, and we haven't even really started the news proper. So let's get this party ripping along. What do you think?
I think we should. Okay, so much stuff happened this week. You want to lead it off here?
Yeah, you know, a lot of stuff happened this week. So if we don't get to everything, we can always push some stuff to next week. Or I think we should talk about the stuff that we do feel is more important. I guess, quite sadly, Lou Reed passed away. I'm sure a lot of the Punk News kids probably know Lou Reed is probably one of the most important, I guess, post Elvis musicians of all time. He was in the Velvet Underground, and he created a whole bunch of daring and experimental and interesting music after that. He was 71. He had a liver transplant earlier this year, so no one knows what the cause of death was, but it's almost certainly related to that. Rolling Stone magazine did a nice little retrospective on him, and they closed it out with this quote. They said, this is Lou Reed speaking to Rolling Stone in 1987. All through this, I've always thought that if you thought of it all as a book, then you have the great American novel, every record as a chapter. They're all in chronological order. You take the whole thing, stack it, and listen to it in order. That there's my great American novel. I can't say I was distraught over the death of Lou Reed. It's certainly sad, but he was 71, which isn't ancient, you know, but I mean, he wasn't like 30 or 20, you know.
Given the lifestyle that Lou Reed lived, 71 is a pretty respectable number to get to.
Yeah, yeah. Although it is, I mean, it is a little premature, especially in this day and age. But I guess maybe a better thing to focus on is some of the incredible and daring and experimental music that Lou Reed made. I was actually kind of a tool. On the day that he died, I happened to be in the record store, and I went to buy the new No Bunny CD. And I've got about 5 Lou Reed records, but I don't have Transformer. And I saw Transformer on CD sitting there, and like the complete tool bag that I am, I bought Transformer on the day of Lou Reed's death. Like so many people do, like when Michael Jackson dies or whatever, you know? I felt so cheesy, but I felt well, better late than never. And I gotta say, Transformer is, it's Lou Reed, David Bowie, and Mick Ronson, and it really is a great, great album.
I mean, it's... I on the one hand, don't know if it was really great of Rolling Stone to rap with that... that quote about, you know, the string of albums as the great American novel, because that would mean like the last chapter of his would have been that Metallica thing, right?
Yeah. Do you think that history, I mean, that album is bad. Do you think, so it's kind of unfortunate do you think history will rewrite and say that was a great album? Or do you think people will focus on and say, look how bad, I mean, even though that album was a dud, A, it was daring at least, but more so, Lou Reed has got so much great music. Like, it's inconsequential, that last thing he put out, you know?
No, I mean, that's it. It's inconsequential. I mean, to tell the truth, after the initial, you know, Velvet records that were released and his solo stuff, he had set in motion so much of what became, you know, I'm going to say, like, you say alternative music and, you know, like a really broad sense, that, you know, there was so much influence, so many shockwaves from that initial stuff that... You know, he could have recorded, if he would have spent like the last 10 years recording one shitty Metallica record every year, I don't think it would have diminished his legacy any. Because for better or worse, that was, you know, he would have a very hard time in this day and age. I think even if he released something completely brilliant, you know, overwriting the part of the history book that's going to talk about, you know, Velvet Underground, Nico, and White Light, White Heat, and all this stuff. So I don't know. I don't think he damaged himself with that. If anything, you know, Metallica further damaged themselves. But
not only that, you have to give Lou Reed top props as an artist, because he never coasted. He always was trying something daring. It didn't always work, but when it did work, it was great, you know. So he's a true artist in that respect. If the kids haven't checked out Lou Reed, you can start with the Velvet Underground. Velvet Underground really is a great band, but some of it is difficult. I think the best place to start is his live album called Rock and Roll Animal. That's my favorite Lou Reed album. It's him doing mostly Velvet Underground tunes, but it's kind of like his punk rock phase, where he's like harder, faster, more energetic, and that really is one of the greatest albums of all time. It's called Rock and Roll Animal by Lou Reed. That is a great, great album.
Cool. Well, let's leave that with the listeners. And
if you'll indulge me, I want to read a quote of King Khan made from Canada about his meeting with Lou Reed. And I think maybe this sums up at least one aspect of Lou Reed.
Cool, shoot.
So here's what King Khan of King Khan's Shrines had to say about meeting with Lou Reed. He said, I had a great time. I had more fun with Laurie Anderson, his wife. It was really funny. They invited me to these rehearsals. I got to sit right next to Lou and Laurie. And Laurie was playing this crazy violin synthesizer that she has. They finished the song, and I looked over at Lou Reed and said, that was a really beautiful song, but you've got something on your sweater. He looked down, and I flicked his nose. He then looked at me. He looked kind of like an ancient turtle and grumbled, please don't ever do that to me again. Then it hit me after a moment. Oh, my God, I got invited to his private rehearsal, and the first thing that I did was nose flick Lou Reed. I was in a bit of shock that I went to Laurie and said, oh, man, I think Lou hates my guts now. Then Laurie Anderson said, oh, what, that nose thing? All the best uncles do that. After that, everything was fine. So I think you can read that. That's Punk News' interview with King Khan. And I think that just goes to show that Lou Reed was a thoughtful, intricate artist, but I think he had a sense of humor about himself, too.
Well, there we go.
So anyway, I guess we can move on, Adam. Let's see. It looks like that Weezer is putting out a new album.
There was really, like, nothing good that we could have moved on from, like, you know, Lou Reed passing that wasn't going to sound sort of trivial.
I really just did botch that transition. I really should have given more deference to Lou Reed. I was like, well, Lou Reed's dead. Let's talk about Weezer. You know what I mean? Let's just sum it up and say Lou Reed is a phenomenal musician, and he certainly will be missed. And there's nothing else that I can really say about that.
Now let's talk about Weezer. fuck. You know what? This show hasn't talked about Weezer in a long time, and I think that has really made this show better. Because there was a while. No. I mean, I liked Weezer in like the 90s, period. But there was this weird period where, there was like a lot of stupid Weezer news every week and everyone kept commenting about it. So this show kind of de facto had like four Weezer stories, you know, a month on it. And it seemed like that was all we talked about, and we were even tired of talking about it, so we just stopped. So anyways, let's talk about Weezer. So, they're recording with Rick Ostenak again, right?
Rick Ocasek.
Ocasek, God, wow.
From the Cars. Rick, I guess the Punk News kids might not know, I guess, because the Cars were a while ago now. Cars were a very popular 80s synth pop new wave band, but Rick
Ocasek... Whoa, stop. Here's what I just did there.
What did you just do?
One of the most Grammy-winning accordion artists, polka artists in the world, ever in history, is a guy named Walter Ostenak. He's from St. Catharines. He's from, like, where I live. And my brain swapped his name with Rick from the Cars.
Well,
continue.
They're basically the same, you know.
But yeah, same thing, kind of, right? Music.
But Rick Ocasek, he's produced a whole bunch of music, too, and he married some famous supermodel, and that was famous because he's really ugly, but his wife is a really good-looking supermodel. Rick Ocasek recorded, it looks like, Weezer's Blue Album and the Green Album. The Blue Album, of course, is Weezer's most famous album, and the Green one, not so much. I guess there's not really a whole lot to say about it, except that, Rick Ocasek understands pop music.
Yeah, and I guess if they, like, let him make all the decisions, then this could be a good record. But if they let Weezer make any of the decisions, it's probably going to be a bad record.
Yeah, honestly, there's been two ways to view Rivers Cuomo lately. And one is that he's a daring guy that's willing to try anything out to see if it works. And the other is he's just not even really trying at all, and he's just doing stupid bullshit to distract from not trying at all. Adam, do you have a position? Is Rivers Cuomo a deep artist that is willing to try wild new things, a la Lee Scratch Perry and George Clinton? Or is he just some guy just basically whacking off over the digital recording board?
I would not compare him to Lee Perry or George Clinton.
Well, there's only one other poll.
Oh, no, I mean, one could argue for the tortured genius of Rivers, you know, after... I could say you could have argued.
Adam, are you there? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, you could argue for that even after the Green Album came out. Not that the Green Album was really all that good, but you know, you could have argued that, you know, the direction that he was taking in it was, you know, was informed by his deep artistic reaction to what happened with Pinkerton and trying to recapture something or other. But then everything after that was just like either boring or stupid, and the stupid has been winning with the last few, hasn't it? I mean, I haven't heard the last one that came out except for like the stupid singles, but they were just blinding suns of stupid. And if any non-stupid planets were orbiting those suns, they were just silhouetted by the stupid behind it. So that's where I'm going.
Yeah, I was never a huge Weezer fan. I'm still trying to get into the Blue Album. It still sounds a little boring to me. And I haven't ever really listened to Pinkerton that much, so I should check. I've heard El Scorcho, but I wasn't wowed.
I mean, it wounds me to say that the Blue Album was the first CD I bought ever. It was, I'm trying to think, like, what was it, 1994?
Yeah, probably about that, right.
So I was 94. So I was like, what, 12 or 13 or something like that, 14?
I'm imagining a 12-year-old Adam White, you know, at The Wall or at Sam Goody, you know. I'd like to buy this copy of the Weezer's Blue Album, please.
Yeah, right? And that's pretty much how I sound now.
For some reason, I'm imagining you like you're like 6 instead of 12, so like you can't even like see over the counter, and like just your hands are like putting the thing over the counter.
Is this like a bunch of dollar bills kind of crushed in my hand, right? So I have as much reason as any to have like a stupid emotional connection to this band, in which I will forgive all of their dumb things. But man, the stuff that they've released lately, I don't know. It doesn't really matter too much the Frico K6 on this. I don't think I want to listen to it.
Is it possible that they come back and have a late career resurgence and just do something completely amazing? Is that possible?
Lots of stuff is possible.
True.
Is it probable? Am I putting money on it? No.
Well, speaking of things that aren't probable, Bad Religion just released a Christmas album, which is sort of oxymoronic, if you will. We talked about this a little bit earlier, and Adam, you, me, and Brian Yancey kind of tussled on whether or not it makes sense for Bad Religion to put out a Christmas album. At any rate, I was surprised that they had so much. And actually, on the podcast last time when we talked about this, I switch non-secular and secular. There's a lot of secular songs on this album. But there's a lot of non-secular songs on this too. I just did it again because I'm an idiot. So there's a lot of religious songs on this album. Well, what do you think the band is trying to achieve? Is it a gag Ween style, or are they just saying we like Christmas jams even if they have a Christmas bend? I mean, a religious bend.
My thought, having seen by at this point the cover art, heard a few of the songs, I haven't listened to the whole thing yet, is that they have an internal justification for this that is, I'm going to say not goofy, because the band doesn't really do goofy. Like they're not trying to be flippant about it. So there's probably a portion of them that are like that are approaching this from a, you know, haha, we're going to play these fairly straight, although in Bad Religion style, and by the fact that it's not purposefully taking the piss, that is what is subversive about it. There's an element that's probably that, and then there's probably an element, and I gotta imagine that this is that the second element is the actual Greg Graffin one, where he's looking at it and going, well, these are, you know, a lot of these are classic folk songs, and that's what I like, so, you know, I'm cool singing them, I'm comfortable enough in what I do that I can sing them, but I don't know, it's still sort of curious to me that it exists at all, so.
Yeah, I wonder if the way to read this is like Crass actually did almost something identical to this. I think it was 1982. They put out a 7-inch record called Merry Crassmas, but it played at 33, so it's about 10 minutes, 12 minutes long, and it's Crash doing, like, Muzak versions of Christmas songs, and they never really explained why they did it, although at the very end, it's funny, Crash's drummer and co-lead songwriter, Penny Rimbaud, comes in as Santa Claus, and it's just hilarious to hear Penny Rimbaud as Santa Claus, you know? So here's what somebody said, actually. This is Dr. Nick. Here's what he said. Glad to know that atheists are just as guilty of capitalizing off a religious holiday just like Christians do. So could it be bad religion is saying, well, if Christians are going to make money off of it, we'll just show how money-driven Christmas really is by putting out a Christmas album? Or are they truly saying that they like these songs and... Or maybe, you know what though, honestly, I think everybody's putting too much thought. Honestly, I think I just thought, wouldn't it be kind of fun if we just did a Christmas album? And like, they're like, let's do it. They probably bang this out in like, you know, a week, you know?
So, and I think that's, the truth of it is probably that it was, you know, quickly and cheaply recorded. I mean, it's not like they had to write these songs, right? Yeah. You know, it was quickly and cheaply recorded and probably not, you know, overlabored in the strategy department, and they had him, and they were like, shit, let's just put it out and see what happens. Which is way, way more boring than there being some sort of crazy, you know, high or low art answer to this, but that was probably what happened.
I do like how they're not giving any explanation for it. So, you know, and that's what makes bands interesting. Speaking of having explanations, I don't know if anybody even cares about this story at all. Adam, you can be my mirror on this. Dan Reagan quit, the trombonist of Real Big Fish, quit Real Big Fish. He said he basically had a family and he wanted to raise his kids, which is a good as reason as any to quit a band. Do people care about Real Big Fish at all anymore? I mean, is that like something like some people are really into, Real Big Fish?
Yes. And I say this being a 90s ska kid who was at one point really into Real Big Fish and did not care to tell anyone that. These days, not so much. To a band like this that, you know, could basically, I mean, I know they release records, but they don't release records that really play outside of their existing fan base. They continue to tour and to play to, you know, a fan base that they established in the 90s that was in, you know, super passionate about this, you know, about the third wave style. They were the right age that, you know, that was what was fun to them. You know, they might not listen to, you know, they might not have gone on to become, you know, huge music, you know, aficionados or whatever else, or they may have, but they'll put that aside when Real Big Fish come to town. So like they have this devoted following that's still willing to come out to their shows and to have fun. And, you know, there's a reason why this band can still play and draw these days. And it's, you know, whatever they did at that time to establish that fan base, they did it right. So to those people, you know, Dan was a guy that was a big part of the band's personality. So I'm sure it sucks for them. So yeah, I don't think this is, you know, this is not the death of Lou Reed in terms of story significance, but there is a certain, you know, slice of the kind of like the third wave ska punk fan base that this matters to. So, you know, I'll give them their due.
You think there's anybody that's like, man, I can't believe Dan Reagan quit Real Big Fish. My week is ruined. Is there somebody out there like that?
Mondo?
Very, very true.
Potentially. No, I don't know about that. There's probably a segment of their devoted fan base that is just like, man, we're never going to get to see that show again.
Hey, Adam, like, what's that? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like to me, that moment, although now that we're talking about a much better band now at this point, was that when Mark Lind, who went by the name of like QMAX 420, who was the toaster in the Slackers, when he left the band, that to me was that was a crushing blow. With the Slackers used to come to town, like to like the university town that I went to in Ontario. They were here at one point for like twice a year in like the early 2000s, which was amazing. And then Mark left, and they came back, and I'd seen them since, but there was a dynamic that was changed there. Like that guy was such. I mean, hell, you're the guy at the mic, you know. You know, shouting at the crowd, getting everyone fired up. You know, you're not necessarily the lead singer, but you're singing, you know, a few of the songs that everyone really loves. And even if you're not singing, you're up there dancing and partying, and like, you know, you're you're the center of attention. So for having, you know, for having him leave the band, even though really like Vic was, you know, was the guiding musical force there, and you still had guys like Dan Hilliard in the band that were still contributing a lot, it didn't feel the same. So I can get that from a different ska perspective here.
The magic was gone.
They're still a great band. They would still play fun shows, but you know, something was missing.
Well, we all have to grow up sometime. And Adam, what's that behind you?
It might be a...
Oh, shit! It's a track keeper! He's back! Track keeper, what's going on? Sorry, Adam. Sorry, John. I didn't mean to disturb you, but of course we're all a little disturbed. This track is a re-release from the Dwarves re-release called The Dwarves Are Younger and Even Better Looking. It's out on Recess Records and is a re-release of their pop punk classic. This track is called Theme from Vice Lords, but you might want to cover your ears because I find the song to be a little shocking.
This following program is dedicated to the city and people of San Francisco.
Everywhere that we go, everybody knows. You only can trust us as far as you can throw. Everywhere that we go, yeah. Everybody knows what they know, what they know, yeah. But yeah, everywhere that we go, everybody knows. Life in the fast lane, must surely come to blows. Everywhere that we go, yeah. Everybody knows what they know, yeah. But we know that we know more. We know that fucking up is hard, yeah. It's so hard to do, but we do, yeah, we do, yeah, we do. Alright, now let's go. Yeah, we do, yeah, we do. Why not try to talk about it, yeah, but yeah, when it's hard, so hard to do, but we do, yeah, we do, yeah, we do. Yeah, 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 when it's hard, so hard to do.
Back on the punk, I gotta say, Adam, I did not expect the track keeper to bust out a Dwarves jam. I mean, I thought he was into like death, doom, and gloom, but apparently the track keeper likes the ladies.
Well, you know, track keepers, you know, they're
track keepers
have human too.
They have needs. They're inhuman too.
They have
too.
Needs.
They're inhuman.
That's where
too.
I was going.
Well, speaking of inhuman, Adam, you want to kick off the second half and get this baby on rolling?
All right, yeah. Black Flag, Greg Ginn and Company, they've announced their long awaited is not the right word, talked about new record. It is called What The... dot, dot, dot.
Do you think it's What The, or like, What The? Or is it like, What The?
I'm going to say, like, What The, and then it trails off. Which is due out on November 5th, 2013. You can find the track listing on Punk News. There are 22 songs on this thing. The cover art is... John, I'm going to give this to you, John. Just do this.
Okay. We have to dance lightly here, and here's why. A lot of people didn't like the cover art or were shocked by the cover art. It's unlike, it's entirely unlike Raymond Pettibon's art, but I mean, if Black Flag did try to mimic Raymond Pettibon's art in light of the Black Flag slash Flag litigation, that would probably be in poor choice. The guy, the person that did the art was Ron Reyes, the second vocalist for Black Flag, and he's also the current vocalist for Black Flag. Originally, he talked a little bit about this on his Facebook. Originally, they asked him to do a cover, so he wanted to do something like The Descendants, I think he said kind of like The Descendants. It was in black and white originally, so they asked him to like add color to it. So, before anyone like gets hypercritical at anything, it's important to know that this wasn't like a marketing firm that designed this. You know, it was a human being that was just trying to do a good job. So, I wouldn't say it's the best cover art of Black Flag, but now that I have some understanding behind it, that they were going for kind of like a Descendants or like, you know, early 80s SoCal thing, it kind of makes a little bit more sense.
I mean, no undue disrespect to Ron or anything like that, but it really looks like the cover of your high school ska band's, demo.
Somebody said Warheads. You remember Warheads, those little candies?
Yeah. Shit. Yeah. I don't know. I think that to not judge the art, I think that the art does not seem to fit a Black Flag record. If you were to have taken the Black Flag and the font and the bars off of it, and to have showed this to someone along with say like half a dozen other random punk cover arts similarly anonymized this year, and said which of these is going to be a Black Flag record, it'd be pretty far down the list. And the fact that they're playing as Black Flag, the fact that the four bars are on the cover of the record as well, means that you can't divorce, this musical venture from the, artistic legacy of this band.
True.
Like it's in that continuum. It's not like they can say, this is a new thing, so this is the art for it and fuck you. And if that was the case, if the band was named something else, then I think that, people, may not like the cover art or anything like that. They're not going to hum and haw as much as they had. But this is for better or worse, a Black Flag record. It is canonically a Black Flag record. So it's going to be judged by that. And that's I think what people are going on here.
I agree with most of that. There is some fantastic Black Flag art that isn't Pettibon. People forget that Damaged is which Culver, isn't that his name? That famous photographer, Edward Culver. Yeah, that's who did it.
Yeah,
he did. I think he did the Damaged. I mean, the Louie single, which has some really good art too. There's not a whole lot to really say about the cover art. I mean, people can read it as they will. I would say what's more interesting is the track. 22 tracks is a lot of tracks. It's the longest Black Flag album by far. However, I will say this, Adam. I am optimistic because I saw a lot of the tracks, despite the first two singles, a lot of the tracks are only like a minute and a half long. So I got to say, man, Greg Ginn doing a minute and a half songs, Ron Reyes singing on a minute and a half songs. I went from cautiously optimistic to excited. I'm genuinely excited to hear this album.
That is the saving grace of this whole thing. The Flag lawsuit aside, the inevitable, I think, comparisons you're going to get to, the quality of this, to say the quality of Off aside, I think that the fact that these are in all likelihood going to be short, fast songs is that is what this thing has going for it right now.
A lot of people are reading a lot into the titles, like "You Gotta Be Joking," "Give Me All Your Dough," that kind of. I mean, do you think that's a reference to the Flag, Black Flag, conflict, or do you think it just all coincidence?
Oh, it probably factors in there.
I'm trying to remember that there's an Off song where Keith Morris talks about the 2003 Black Flag reunion. I can't remember what. Maybe it's Wrong, I think. Or no, Feelings Were Meant to Be Hurt. Yeah, that's it. Let me Google the lyrics to Feelings Were Meant to Be Hurt real quick. So, Adam, please talk about something for the next 30 seconds.
Like a real punky story? Or,
oh, no. I got it right now anyways. So here we go. Here's what Keith Morris wrote in the Off. Keith Morris is an Off, and they've got a song called Feelings Were Meant to Be Hurt. And here's what he said. He's referring to the 2003 Black Flag reunion, where Keith Morris was asked to be a part of it, but then he kind of quit because the band was playing like really slow and stuff. He says, "Oh, well, no, I got the wrong song." Anyway, he says like, "There's a line that says that he says you say we're playing too fast. Do you have your head up your ass or something like that?" And basically, he's criticizing Greg Ginn for playing his songs too slow that he feels. And I noticed one of the songs here is Slow Your Ass Down, which definitely seems like, I mean, if this was hip-hop, no question people would read that as, like, a shot back, you know?
And you know what? If we end up with you know, like an old-school Jamaican sound system-style, you know, diss tracks back and forth between the various Black Flag incarnations,
that would be awesome.
Right now. I'm all for that.
But you do remember that sort of did happen, believe it or not. Because remember when Keith Morris left the band, they recorded when Keith Morris left the band, he formed the Circle Jerks. Keith Morris was Black Flag's first singer. They recorded the song "I Don't Care," which originally was a Black Flag song. Keith Morris took his lyrics, so Black Flag recorded "You Don't Have Anything Personal Against Me." You bet we've got something personal against you, which was a Keith Morris diss. Then Black Flag has the song called Room 13 or whatever, and the Circle Jerks have the song called Room 13, and they seem to be shooting back at each other. The Off song I was referring to is Cracked. Here's what he says. "My night with at the garbage dump, being played for a chump. Are you kidding? We were playing too fast. Have you been smoking pot, or is your head up your ass? Too much confusion, piling up like trash. I lost my head. I finally cracked." And a lot of people read that as Keith Morris taking his shot at Greg Ginn. So, I mean, honestly, if we've got two bands, I mean, honestly, I think healthy competition is good. And, you know, I mean, Criminal Minded, one of the greatest hip-hop albums of all time, is a diss record. It's the battle between the Juice Crew and KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions. So, I mean, if we get, like, two bands really trying to blow each other out of the water, everybody wins because you get great music all around.
You know what? That may be the best thing to come out of this. That would be awesome. Let's hope for that.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed for a live Flag album. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that this Black Flag album is going to be good. I think it will. And I'm super excited for the new Off albums and the new Chuck Dukowski Sextet albums.
It is not a bad time to be John Gentile right now.
I got to say, man, the past like 2 years, just been an insane amount of Black Flag related stuff, you know? So
cool.
Adam, is there another album that people are excited for these days?
Oh, are they? So the long-awaited, much-anticipated, that those two things mean exactly the same, right? New full-length from Against Me finally has a release date. Transgender Dysphoria Blues will be out on January 21st, 2014, via the band's own Total Treble. With Resist Records set to release it in Australia. Once again, they will follow up 2010's White Crosses. And in the interim, they've released a few other things. They had the Russian Spies 7-inch out in 2011 and the True Trans EP earlier this year. Parts of this record were recorded at Studio 606, Earth Sound Studio, Motor Studio, and Total Treble Studio. In addition to longtime members Lord Jane Grace and guitarist James Bowman, Transgender Dysphoria Blues marks the debut of drummer Adam Willard. And you guys know Adam from Rock Over the Crypt and Angels and Airwaves and lots of other stuff. And Fat Mike of NoFX performed bass on at least two of the album's 10 tracks.
Count them two.
Song.
Count them two. Two.
Yes,
yes
two.
Two.
Two. The amazingly titled All Caps Lock, Fuck My Life 666. And the song Unconditional Love. So there are 10 tracks on this thing. The cover art is fascinating. You can find the all the details and everything on Punk News right now. So This may be the biggest piece of news about this until we get to hear one of the studio tracks on here. John, you're excited about this.
I am excited about this, and I'm going to reiterate what I've said before. I think in some ways the punk community is hurting itself in that, like, everyone's like, not a big deal, you know, a transgender person's being transgender, not a big deal. The fact is the majority of the world, nevertheless North America, has not been exposed to transgender people transitioning in front of them before. So I think it's incredibly brave of what Large Anne Grace is doing, and I think it's an interesting time and a monumentous time in music and pop culture as a whole, where we see someone that no one really had any inclination was transgender to now fully presenting themselves as a woman. So I do think this is a big deal. I'm excited to hear this album. I think the album's going to be really cool, really interesting, and I think it's going to be a career-defining album. I really wanted to see the Large Jane Grey solo tour, but I was actually out in the Bay when she was in Philadelphia. So, but I think people have been saying these jams are good.
Yeah, I mean, like, I almost wish that they had not released the True Trans EP, at least not with some of the same songs that are re-recorded for this, because it would have been great to come into this whole thing fresh.
True.
Not have heard some of that. But hey, what are you gonna do? I gotta say, the cover art to this is badass to me. Like, that is fucking punk rock cover art.
Yeah, I agree.
Like,
I gotta say, yeah. it reminds me of Crass, not to be too cliche, but the way it's like, it looks like an old textbook photo or something repurposed. You know, that's clever and that's cool. I was gonna say something else. Oh, you know, I mean, do you think the modern age has, like, made this less of an impact in exposure? I mean, because think about it. Back in the day, I'm thinking, what are some, like, when Bowie first was Ziggy Stardust, people were blown away, because before then he was just some folk singer, you know, and then all of a sudden here's this guy, you know, that's like from outer space or whatever. And then when Bowie came back as Thin White Duke, he wasn't this guy from outer space anymore. He was like this nasty, mean Anglo-Saxon creature, you know. Or how about, like, when The Clash, there really wasn't a huge lead up to London Calling. I think London Calling the single was released, and then all of a sudden, here's this gigantic album. People didn't expect it. Whereas this, people have been eased into it, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, there's two kind of, like, it sounds
two, completely count them two.
Two, count them two. Completely contradictory things, I think, that have gone on here. Is that the one is that, you know, we have had time to be confronted with Laura Jane's story and her journey and what's been going on with her. And, you know, there has been that time, I think, for the community to, you know, wrap their heads around this and, you know, decide how they feel about it or whatever between that announcement and the release of this record. But on the other hand, we're also, you know, on the one hand, we've been saturated with it. And on the other hand, we are entirely a short attention span culture right now. So does the wider music press, you know, or the wider, I don't know, I hate to say, like, entertainment's press or anything like that, or just like the news or whatever, are they in tune with this story right now? Probably not. I mean, it's, you know, when it was news, it's so far past the news cycle at this point. So, you know, we're both used to it and distracted at the same time.
Very true. So I'm excited to see what happens. And other than that, I think the most we can say is I think it's going to be a very interesting album, and we'll see what happens, you know. And honestly, I don't mean this in a negative way. I think it's going to be the end of Against Me. After this, I think Large Anne Grace is going to become Large Anne Grace or something else, to tell you the truth.
I don't think that is a bad assumption.
Yeah. Speaking of unexpected things, is all of a sudden Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day and Norah Jones are releasing an Everly Brothers cover album. They just released it about 5 days ago, and it's coming out in a month. So they announced it 1 month before its release date, which is an incredibly short time frame, especially in today's music economy where albums are trumpeted for a year, you know, 9 months. I gotta say, I kind of like Bad Religion's Christmas album. I don't think this is supposed to be any big thing. I think it's just two artists having fun in the studio.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, you know, if you have the luxury of being able to go into the studio with a friend and record, you know, something as, I don't want to say esoteric, I want to say, like, just unnecessary. That sounds like I'm demeaning it, and that's not what I mean. Just fine, esoteric. Something as esoteric as a out of nowhere Everly Brothers cover album between two artists that have no, you know, I maybe they're on the same label, but have no previous artistic collaboration to note, and come from completely different genres, is, you know, it's something I guess you can do if you are, you know, if you have the privilege to do that. I mean, it's clear this was not a, I can't imagine that this was a big commercial decision on anyone's point. Like, the kids aren't chomping for
Everly Brothers covers.
Everly Brothers covers. Nora Jones is, you know, she plays more to, I think, my mom than she plays to, like, teenagers, right? Like, she's not Miley Cyrus by any means. And Billie Joe Armstrong is, like, 700 years old at this point. So I don't think that, like, kids care too much about that. So, like, I don't know. I don't see, like, a bunch of teenagers lining up outside their you know, non-existent record store on November 25th to grab, like, a shiny new, you know, shrink-wrapped CD of Billy Joe and Nora. So, this is, I don't know, out of left field. Fuck, that's what I was trying to say, right? This is out of left field. It's going to exist, and it is super unoffensive in most respects to me.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting how things go in cycles. I'm sort of reminded in the 70s. In the 70s, I think it was more of a commercial thing where labels would make artists put out like two albums a year, you know, and at an insane rate. Like, if you look, I'm a pretty big Roxy Music fan. Not only did Roxy Music put out an album a year, but the main guy, Brian Ferry, also put out an album a year. And he was pumping out so much stuff. A lot of Brian Ferry albums are just remake of Roxy Music songs or covers. Like, his first two albums were, like, completely covers albums. Look at Lou Reed. Lou Reed's first four albums, like, half the albums were remake of Velvet Underground tunes, you know? And it's just because the label wanted artists to put out music so quickly, they really didn't have time to gasp, and they just had to bang stuff out. What that led to, it led to a lot of interesting and daring experiments in music, particularly with Bowie, who did, like, wildly interesting stuff in the mid-70s, just because they were ripping through stuff so quickly that they didn't have time to think, well, whether or not it would be a good song, just an interesting song, and it led to some of his best stuff. Here, I guess because maybe it is so expensive to put out music these days, we just see artists, you know, banging out stuff just on a whim, and I approve of that. Hope, I mean, I don't think these albums are going to be great. But, I mean, if artists just keep doing daring stuff like this, then we might get some real interesting stuff. Of course, the flip side of that is the Weezer thing, where they say, let's just act off any stupid idea that we have, you know, and let's put Hurley on the cover of the album, you know? So.
Weezer's not going to come unscathed out of this episode. Well, I'm sure they're heartbroken by our...
I love daring bands. And I love weird bands and bands that do unexplainable things, but with Weezer, it just seems too perfect in that it's like, are they really doing something daring or are they just doing something stupid? You know, like, well, what was that like that album? Well, I can't remember. They had one single that was like, it was like Hot Dogs and Beans or the name of the album or song or whatever. And it was like just so pointless and silly, you know?
Pointless and silly is my kind of go-to.
Maybe I'm being jaded. I don't know. And I hate to be jaded, but a pork and beans, that was it. What are they, hot dogs and beans?
it's a regional delicacy. That's, you're done. Yeah. You get it from there. So, yeah, I don't know. Is there anything to say about this?
I mean, I have one last thing to say about this. Is looking at the black and white picture, like there's a microphone in front of Billy Joe Armstrong's hair. And so it looks like he's got two cat ears. And I'm like, why does he have Sue Catwoman's haircut? And then I realize it's just a microphone in front of his hair.
The world needed to know that.
It did. It really did. Adam, I think we should close out with this Big D and the Kids Table thing, just because it's so wild and wacky. I know we're running a little long, so we'll speed it up, but this is crazy. So
yeah, all right.
At Big D and the Kids Table show in Poughkeepsie, New York, what happens was the lead singer, David McWayne, the guards were kind of roughing up somebody in the audience, so he jumps into the audience to try to separate him, to put himself between the bodyguards and the kid that was getting roughed up, and the bodyguards put him in like a chokehold and almost made him pass out. But not only did they put him in a chokehold, after he literally tapped out by tapping the guy on the shoulder, they continued to choke him until he almost lost consciousness.
This is a good tour story one day for when Big D gets in an interview and they're like, what's the weirdest thing that's happening on tour? There's a great recap of it, the Dying Scene posted, where they went and they talked to McWayne, and you can read the, we have an excerpt of it on Punk News. You can find the link to Dying Scene there. I don't know what to say about this.
I mean, I honestly think it's just back in the 80s, bouncers were beat up by bands a lot. I've never seen that happen at all, and I don't really think it happens now. I think it's just a fluke. I think the bouncer was just some jerk, you know, and he wanted to be a tough guy. And you know, David McWayne is not a big guy. I mean, anybody that's beating up a little guy like Dave McWayne, like you're not a tough guy. So it's just a fluke. Somebody wanted to be tough, and as Joan Jett said, there's always assholes someplace, you know?
Yeah, I don't even know. I don't know where to bring it. Go read the story. Go read the comments that kind of came through. It is a... It is odd. Hold on, I'm going to grab something out of McWayne's letter that he gave here, because it is...
Yeah, honestly, McWayne took an interesting position. He didn't fight back, and his position was, well, it's good that I didn't fight back because I would have gotten hurt more, and that guy might have killed me, and then he would feel bad about it. And people are like, good for him for being nonviolent. I would say he probably made the right decision in that circumstance, because he said he's not a tough guy or not a big guy or not a big fighter, so he really couldn't fight back. But I think, and this is my personal opinion, I think the idea of nonviolence can go too far. And that sometimes if somebody's being violent or somebody's being aggressive towards you or towards someone you care about or just an innocent person, it's kind of your duty to respond back to make them stop doing what they're doing, because otherwise they'll just keep doing it. I mean, it goes back to bullies. You know, I mean, if you try to ignore a bully, he's just going to keep being a bully because he wants attention. But if you step up to a bully, 99 out of 100 times they run away scared. And so I don't think nonviolence is the best solution to every problem.
All right, here's where I wanted to go, because I thought this was pretty interesting here. And it was just kind of his recap of the end of it. So this is from our pals over at Dying Scene, and this is from the letter that David McWayne put out. He said, as for what happened the rest of the night, so this is after the choking incident, oh, just anarchy. The promoter didn't show up, so no one was in charge. When I came to, I saw an angry crowd moving towards the gentleman who had choked me, and I did the same thing. I got in between them and said, leave him alone, leave him alone. We were there to play music, ska music, happy music, so with the help of a frazzled, tiny female bartender, we clumsily got the show back on. I only asked if the gentleman who choked me be ejected from the club, and with showboarding authority, that request was not honored. So we played the show. Our listeners come first, the innocent people working in the club come second. And my run-in with that was that I feel that the product of the tension and the current state of our country comes first. A lot more happened. Good people acted as good as they could. It was messy. It was long. And after the show, it was still anarchy. Something worse was always on the table. In the end, don't light a torch or anything against anyone. Like I said, this gentleman and I are very lucky. Nothing is on CNN, is it? Let's move on. This gentleman does not need any more flack than I assume he's already gotten. It's a closed book. So... There's some really interesting stuff that he's kind of been writing there. You can find the full thing over at Dying Scene.
So I guess other than that, speaking of people getting choked out, you know, the track keeper, he just walked back in, and he says he wants to get choked because he's into that kind of thing. So Adam, I don't want to get involved in this. I think we should just kind of let the track keeper choke himself or something. What do you think?
I'm not involved in this at all.
All right, well, Track Keeper, take it away.
My punk ghouls, how's everyone doing for our third song? This track is submitted by one of the readers. It's by a band called Sunny on the Causeway. Of course, I prefer Bloody on the Causeway. This track is called Dumb, and it's off their album, Dumb. I hope you enjoy it, but don't mind me. I'll just be hanging around.
So stay away from me with the dumb shit, you know? And all these tight jeans, can't dig it. Tight jeans and big sneakers make you look like a clown, you fucking asshole. Yeah!
Thanks for listening to the Punk News Podcast. I gotta say, Adam, I did not expect that creepy little track keeper to play a brand new song by Sunny on the Causeway. I was surprised.
He is an enigma wrapped in a leathery hide. So
I'll tell you that anyways. Well, thanks again for listening to the Punk News Podcast, people. As always, the opinions expressed on the Punk News Podcast are the opinions of the people making them exclusively and do not in any way express the opinions of punknews.org. The track keeper speaks for himself. He can do what he wants. We got nothing to do with that guy. Thanks for listening. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. If you have a band, Sunny on the Causeway was one of the bands that submitted to us. If you want your band, it has to be your band to be played on the Punk News Podcast, shoot us an email at podcast@punknews.org or johng@punknews.org, and maybe we'll play your track. Other than that, Adam, that's about all I got. What do you think, baby?
I think we've inflicted enough upon the good people of the internet tonight.
Well, have a happy, safe Halloween out there, and we will see you after the Day of the Dead.